Good morning. May it please the court. As Mr. Moyer said, my name is Darius Agloza. I'm with the law firm of Latham & Watkins, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Apriva Shareholder Litigation Company, LLC. This limited liability company is made up of four members. Three of the members are institutional investors, and a fourth is an individual investor, Mr. Eric Vandenberg. Together, these four investors held 66% approximately of the economic interest in an entity known as Apriva, which was a small Northern California-based medical device company that had developed a promising anti-stroke technology known as Plato. The complaint in this case states alternative causes of action for breach of contract and misrepresentation arising out of a July 2002 merger by which Apriva was acquired by the appellees. Specifically, the complaint alleges that the appellees tortiously induced Apriva's board and shareholders to approve the merger based on a number of false and misleading representations, and also alternatively, that they breached certain performance obligations under the merger agreement itself. The cases before this court, after the trial court's entry of an order of summary judgment dismissing this lawsuit, on the basis that the former Apriva shareholders, the members of the LLC, lack standing to assert their claims. As set forth in our papers, the trial court's order was erroneous for several independent reasons. Most significantly, the trial court erred by entering summary judgment on an inadequate record. Although characterized as being based on a lack of standing, the trial court's opinion actually appears to premise entry of summary judgment on the proposition that the former Apriva shareholders surrendered their rights to assert claims against the defendants rather than that they were not entitled to mount a legal challenge in the first instance. Appellant's standing in the latter sense, their basic right to mount a legal challenge, is not really in dispute. These former shareholders are plainly third-party beneficiaries under the merger agreement and under established Delaware law that gives them standing.
I thought that the holding was that they hadn't surrendered their rights in every capacity, but only in their capacity individually. That is, their rights could be asserted, but it had to be done through the two shareholder representatives. And that would be a standing issue, would it not?
Right, and that is correct. What I'm trying to distinguish, Your Honor, is the difference between having it in the first instance versus actively voluntarily surrendering it by virtue of those agreements that the trial court relied upon.
Well, on that subject, the record, at least as far as I could gather, doesn't show what percentage of the shareholders approved the merger. I gather it was at least 66%. Was it 100%? Are we to assume that?
Your Honor, my understanding was that it was fully approved by all of the shareholders. As third-party beneficiaries, these members of the LLC would clearly have standing. Also, as aggrieved parties, as persons who were damaged by the misrepresentations, they also would have standings. The issue here is whether these former Apriva shareholders surrendered those rights to mount the challenge. The court's determination is really based on its interpretation of two agreements. There's the July 2002 merger agreement itself, which established or appointed, rather, two shareholder representatives to administer the post-merger agreement, the agreement actually post-merger. Secondly, there was a shareholder representative agreement that was entered into by the five major shareholders of Apriva. Notably, four of those five shareholders are presently before the court right here today.
Now, Mr. Lesh brought a separate action, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And he's the fifth signatory of that shareholder representative agreement.
And that action was dismissed and, I assume, not appealed. That's a final.
No, our understanding is that it presently is on appeal.
That is on appeal.
That was dismissed by Judge Scott, and it was Judge Herlihy that had our case.
So what is the status of that appeal?
I believe that there, Our best understanding is that they're just in the briefing stages right now, the opening stages of the briefing on that appeal.
And they're the same issues in that case?
Similar issues in that case. It is a standing issue, though it's as best as I can characterize it, and I sort of hate to sort of characterize, you know, Dr. Lesh's lawsuit, but it's presented differently than ours is. But standing is at bottom what's going on.
Does the record reflect why they didn't jointly act to bring a single lawsuit?
No, Your Honor. And that is, you know, as I'll get to, I believe that that's really one of the reasons why the error that was committed by the trial court here is, in fact, material. Because that's precisely the kinds of evidence of circumstances in the making of this contract, which we would have liked to have presented had we had the reasonable opportunity to present such evidence when this motion was converted from a motion to dismiss to a motion for summary judgment. 12B provides.
How about getting to that right away? Because I don't like mysteries. So, you know.
Certainly.
Why cause all this problem for all the parties, or all the plaintiffs anyhow, when they could have acted without having to face a standing issue?
There were probably about 50 total investors in Apriva. Five of those investors control 85% of the company. So in a lot of ways, it's a lot more like a closely held corporation. These five investors are all very sophisticated people. We have sophisticated Silicon Valley institutional investors. We have two very well-known technologists in the Northern California area, Mr. Vanderberg, Dr. Lesh. Control is really what it's about. My clients are adamant that they did not surrender their rights to pursue affirmative claims against EV3 and such that they wish to control their own destiny. Dr. Lesh wishes to control his own destiny. And that is really at bottom what this is all about and why we have two separate lawsuits. Because
I'm not understanding what you're saying. If there's a concern on the part of all the plaintiffs that they're not getting paid what they should be getting paid, or that there were misrepresentations made in connection with the merger or any of those things, are we dealing with such huge ego issues that the parties would rather risk having no remedy at all than work together?
Well, that's a bridge that we haven't come to, Your Honor. And if forced to come to that bridge, my sense is we're all going to come together. However, there is no language in these agreements on which to hook some intent by my clients to alienate, transfer, surrender their individual rights to pursue these claims. If I may, one second, I'm getting a little bit dry. And, Your Honor, it also transcends.
There was some language, though, wasn't there, arguably, to the effect that, you know, by approving or voting for the merger agreement, the shareholders surrendered their rights to do individually whatever the representatives were either required or permitted to do under the merger agreement.
And that's
important. So your argument has to be, yes, but the representatives were neither required nor permitted to bring a lawsuit on behalf of the shareholders against the company and its fiduciaries, right?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, and that is exactly our position. A close inspection of these grants of authority to the shareholder representatives discloses that what's really at stake is they're granting very limited, enumerated duties, rights, and responsibilities. For instance, in the recital D to the shareholder representative agreement, there actually is the grant of authority to pursue certain kinds of litigation claims, indemnification claims that arise under the merger agreement. The shareholder representatives are given that explicit authority.
But those examples are not expressly stated as exhaustive under the agreement, correct?
Exactly, but if you
let me ask it this way.
I apologize.
As I read the relevant portions of the agreement, there's nothing that expressly requires the shareholder representatives to be the plaintiffs in an action to enforce the merger agreement,
right,
or for misrepresentations relating to the merger. Does it expressly state that shareholder representatives are permitted to do that. The problem is the agreement doesn't specifically negate that power either. So where are we?
Well, it negates it in one respect, and that is with respect to those indemnification claims that I mentioned. I believe that under the principle of inclusio unis, exclusio ulterioris, if you're going to be granting some very limited litigation rights, the presumption is that you didn't intend to grant these broader, other, different types of litigation rights. So there is, in fact, language.
That's a rule of construction.
That is a rule. Exactly. Exactly. So there is language by which this court could conclude that these shareholders, former shareholders of Apriva, in fact, did not intend to surrender the rights by granting narrow, explicit.
Are you arguing that it's a matter of law?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you are, then what is the problem with the conversion to summary judgment? I mean, both sides are making arguments as a matter of law. What's the issue here?
No, if as a matter of law we are correct in our interpretation of the agreement, we don't need to reach those other issues. You know, however, if, for instance, see, there's two possible solutions here, Your Honor. One, that as a matter of law, this contract can be interpreted or should be interpreted to say that these shareholders did not, in fact, intend to surrender their rights.
Or it could be interpreted the way it was interpreted here, which is the other way.
Which is the other way.
Or it could be ambiguous, in which case we have a tribal issue.
Exactly, Your Honor. And all three of those two alternatives, we believe, are the only two plausible ones. Either it's unambiguously in favor of our position, or it's ambiguous and we deserve an opportunity to litigate the issue. So on either of those bases, we believe that the trial court's decision should be reversed.
And how do we select among that menu as a legal matter, as an appellate court?
As a, the threshold legal issue, if the intent is in fact discernible on the face of the contract, as we believe it is, meaning that these shareholder that these former shareholders did not in fact intend to surrender these rights, then I believe that this court, as a matter of law, may just sort of conclude that.
To reach that result, there has to be some principle of construction, of strict construction, isn't that correct? Or some presumption that unless the kind of surrender that was found to exist here took place by virtue of the contract has to be explicit. Where would that principle come from?
It comes from two places. The first place is the complete absence of any express grant of the authority to bring affirmative claims. Secondly, from the grant of narrower litigation rights, from which can be presumed that the broader right was not, in fact, intended to be granted.
But I'm asking what the principle is. That is, I understand what the contract literally says and doesn't say,
mm-hmm,
but what that's an intermediate premise. What's the major premise?
The major
rule of law that you're asking us to apply.
Right, Your Honor. And it's, it's kind of an odd position to be in, but what we're really saying is if a contract does not say X, the contract should not be interpreted to say X. And that's what we mean by the absence of express language.
Strict literal construction.
Strict literal construction.
Are there cases in your brief that you rely on for that position?
It's a well-established principle of law.
That's not my question.
No, there are not, Your Honor.
But you essentially seek to enforce the merger agreement, right?
We do.
Well, isn't enforcement of the agreement carrying out the purpose of the merger agreement?
It is.
And if there's an irrevocable authorization and appointment for purposes of the merger agreement, why doesn't that answer the inquiry?
Because the specific language of the agreement doesn't grant the shareholder representatives any kind of broad authority to do that. It grants them very specific, narrow, enumerated powers that are, in fact, very specifically enumerated. And, you know, when you examine the enumerated powers, it's pretty clear that the intent is to keep it that narrow. And back to the extrinsic evidence. You know, my clients who hold more than 60%, 66% of the economic interest, particularly the three institutionals who have 60% of the economic interest, just very sophisticated parties who wanted to maintain control. And that's the evidence of the facts and circumstances of the makings of this contract that would come into play had we had the opportunity to present evidence.
Run that by us again. What is it? What fact would you attempt to establish if you were entitled to a fact hearing?
That the facts and circumstances surrounding the makings of the contract, the shareholder representative agreement, and the provisions in the merger agreement respecting the appointment of the shareholder representatives were such that they were specifically narrowly drawn not to give the shareholder representatives broad and plenary rights to go and spend a lot of these institutional investors' money. And inferring from those facts and circumstances that there was no intent to just surrender some plenary authority to go off, run amok, and sue other parties.
That's in the event the agreement were found ambiguous, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or not.
I would just like to make, and thank you, Your Honor, for alerting me to that, just one very brief point. We believe there's also a third error here, and that is in connection with the conversion. And that is, had this been interpreted as a 12B1 motion and no conversion be made, the issue would have come up in the trial court as to whether we, my clients should have had the right to either join, amend, or have someone ratify this action. And that was just an opportunity that was denied us by this conversion. Another layer of prejudice, which I can explore at the rest of my rebuttal unless the court has some further questions on that subject.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. To answer two questions, at least, that were brought up in the appellant's time, the Lesch opening briefs were filed. We received them yesterday. They were filed with the Supreme Court, their opening brief. And the issue in the Lesch case is not the same in whole because there was no assignment issue there. Dr. Lesch was the individual not acting jointly with Vandenberg, acting individually. So they don't have the layer of issue there on assignment that he assigned it to someone else. Other than that, Judge Scott's opinion, where he dismissed Dr. Lesch's complaint on standing, on the strength of the merger agreement independently and also on the shareholder representative agreement, is at issue in that appeal.
Did Judge Scott base his opinion in part on Judge Herlihy's decision or not?
He did not, Your Honor, base it at all on that. And we have Judge Scott's opinion below as part of our appendix in the record here.
I just want to make sure that I understand your standing argument correctly. It appears to come in two parts. The first is that there was no standing because the action, an action of this kind would have to be brought jointly by Mr. Lesch and by the other representative.
Correct.
Secondly, and then the alternative, even if that's not the case, there's no standing here because the action is brought by an assignee and there was no authority to assign in this case.
Correct.
That is, that it would have had to been brought in the names of the shareholders individually. Is that correct?
It would have to be brought by the shareholder.
Who are members of the LLC.
Right. The assignment issue, Your Honor, is simply that pursuant to Section 16.1, the shareholders have no right to assign any rights or obligations under this agreement.
But they did.
But they did, and that assignment is void.
And therefore?
And therefore, they do not have standing. This plaintiff does not have standing to bring the claims.
Right. And the parties who would have standing, if your legal theory about the assignment is correct, would be the individuals who did the assigning. The individuals or entities who assigned their rights.
Well, I would answer it this way. The party that would have standing would be Dr. Lesh and Dr. Vanderburg acting jointly on behalf of all the shareholders.
If that first argument is right.
I thought you had
two separate arguments.
In this case, we say that they violated this plaintiff, this LLC that was created.
Now, let me handle it in my way. The main argument is that the only plaintiffs that have standing by virtue of Section 15 of the merger agreement are Dr. Lesh and the other gentleman who's the shareholder representative.
Correct.
I forget his name.
Vanderburg.
Mr. Vanderburg. Okay. I thought your position was that even if that argument is wrong, this particular plaintiff has no standing because it's a plaintiff only by virtue of an assignment, and the assignment is void. Correct.
Say that would correct.
And my only question to you was a follow-up one, and that is that if your first argument is rejected and the assignment argument is accepted, then who would have standing? It would be everyone who did the assigning. Isn't that correct?
It would be, if the first argument is rejected, yeah, it would be the individual shareholders.
Who assigned their rights to the LLC.
Not this LLC.
All right.
Okay. But that's assuming your hypothetical, yes. To go on, the burden here, and in any case, in any court, in any jurisdiction across this country, the plaintiff has to carry the burden of the threshold issue of standing. The burden on the plaintiff here, they have failed. This LLC has failed to establish standing, and in fact, it is impossible as a matter of law to carry that burden.
Do you agree that's a 12b-1 issue?
Well, Your Honor, I think it could have been decided under 12b-1. I think it could have been decided under 12b-6, and I think it could be decided under Rule 56. So I don't think it's exclusively a 12b-1 issue. We did not move under 12b-1. The judge did not rule under 12b-1. But it in hindsight, Your Honor, I suppose, it could have properly, in part, just on the standing issue, have been moved pursuant to 12b-1. But I don't think that's an exclusive rule to move under on the standing issue. And we, in fact, moved under 12b-6 as that issue on standing has been ruled upon by courts in Delaware routinely under 12b-6. So, yes, it could be 12b-1 or 12b-6. And in terms of 12b-6, although Judge Herlihy did convert this to a summary judgment motion, in our opening brief below, we argued and still believe that it did not need to be converted to a summary judgment motion. But when the plaintiff here chose below, page 10 of their opening brief in opposition, to challenge the fact that the SRA, the shareholder representative agreement, was extrinsic to the complaint, they then forced that issue. And I should note, and I think it's very interesting, that they made that argument below. Judge Herlihy, in his opinion, noted that they made that argument. Therefore, when he analyzed the SRA, he analyzed it on a conversion for summary judgment. But in its opening brief, appellant brief in this case, if you look at footnote 4, they say the exact opposite thing. Their footnote 4 in this case, which is interesting, on the record at A302, they argue and state that, A302 is where they argue below, they say, this is the appellant, first, EV3's contention that the SRA may be considered by this court on a Rule 12b-6 motion is erroneous. The SRA is not referred to in the complaint, nor is it an integral part of the complaint, as EV3 contends. They then brought that issue as an issue in front of Judge Hurley. In this case, in their opening brief on footnote 4,
it was your side that brought the SRA into the case.
We did, and we attached it to our motion to dismiss by saying it was integral to the pleadings because the merger agreement, which was attached to the complaint, refers to, by reference, this shareholders representative agreement. If you look at section 13.18 of the merger agreement, which is found at the record at A92, it specifically cross-references a proposed shareholder agreement which needed to be reasonably approved by my client. So there was always contemplated that there would be a shareholders representative agreement executed by all shareholders as part of this merger transaction. On footnote 4 of their opening brief, they say the following. They say the trial court appears to have been under the erroneous impression that it was required to convert defendant's motion because extrinsic evidence had been attached. This is erroneous, even under Rule 12b-6. The courts have carved out an exception to the conversion requirement where the court examines a document that is integral to or explicitly relied upon in the complaint. They can't have it both ways and then argue this procedural defect and then some prejudice. That's all my point was on the shareholder representative agreement.
Well, in this case, both sides appear to contend that the agreement should be construed as a matter of law. That is, the merger agreement, even without reference to the assignment.
Yes, and I agree with that.
All right. And, of course, both sides argue that different, you know, completely opposite interpretations should be or conclusions should be drawn from that agreement. It's only the plaintiff's or the appellant's alternative argument that brings into question the procedure that was used here.
That's true. That's true. And on that, on the merits, Your Honor, this was ruled upon by two Superior Court judges that found that the merger agreement was clear and unambiguous. The fact that the two parties, or one of the parties, says there's some ambiguity, that's not what a court looks at. The court looks at the plain meaning of the words in the contract, and if their court finds that there is no ambiguity and it's clear, the court can rule as a matter of law, which both Judge Scott did below and Judge Herlihy did below. And what's interesting in what Judge Herlihy did.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Before we get to that, let's. It is correct, is it not, that there are, the universe contains only three possibilities. That is, that the agreement is clear as a matter of law and should be construed your side's way, or the agreement is clear as a matter of law and should be construed the plaintiff's way, or the agreement is ambiguous and a fact hearing is required.
I would accept that universe.
Okay. For us to affirm, we have to agree with the court that the agreement is unambiguous and that it must be, as a matter of law, construed the way that it was construed.
I'd agree with that proposition as well, Your Honor.
What is your argument as a matter of law?
It is a matter of law that the plain meaning of the merger agreement and also the SRA is clear and unambiguous. And
the SRA only bears on the alternative argument, does it not?
No, the SRA.
You don't need the SRA to win this case, do you?
We don't need it. In fact, Judge Herlihy ruled on page 12 of his opinion that on its own, the merger agreement carries a day. They fail to meet their burden.
Right. So what is it? Argue from the language of the merger agreement. That is, tell us, based on the language of the merger agreement, why there is only one interpretation that can be drawn from that language.
Sections 15.5 of the merger agreement, found at A97, Your Honor, is clear and unambiguous when it says that each shareholder designates and approves Lesch and Vandenberg to act jointly. Goes on to say, with respect to any and all actions, including and without limitation, and it goes on to enumerate some items. All actions, including and without limitations, could not be more clear, Your Honor, and could not be more all-encompassing. By the plain meaning of that, what we have here before this court is an action. It's an action to enforce rights under the agreement at issue. They do not have standing just by the sheer clarity and breadth of Section 15.5. So I would agree with Your Honor that in the universe that you provided me, that when the first item, that if it's clear and unambiguous, as Judge Hurley has found and Judge Scott has found, then we win on this standing issue.
I think that you left out some language when you were quoting.
I was paraphrasing.
Well, but the language that you left out in paraphrasing goes on to say it does discuss or state that with respect to the taking of any and all actions. Actually, it says respect to the taking any and all actions. I guess there are typos in here. And the making of any decisions required to be permitted to be taken by the shareholder's agent.
Correct.
Can't that language be construed to mean that required or permitted modifies actions as well as decisions?
Well, Your Honor, when you start, and I would answer it this way, where that phrase starts with the taking any and all actions and the making of any decisions required or permitted to be taken by the shareholders. If we just look at those words that you say I left out, required or permitted to be taken by the shareholder's agent. Certainly. You don't have to look very far, just by way of an example, that if you look at Section 6.
I'm just asking, does the phrase required or permitted to be taken modify both actions and decisions?
I don't believe it does. I think
must we construe it that way in order to affirm?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think what you... In order to affirm, you just need to read the fact that any and all actions is as broad and all-encompassing as possible. And in the word and, the making of any decisions required or permitted.
I think you're saying that we have to read the word actions as unmodified.
As unmodified.
What if you're wrong?
And if I'm wrong and it does modify the phrase, let's go ahead and say.
If the required or permitted language modifies, you know, is a limitation on the power, the delegated power, to the representatives, what then?
Then you would just, for example, take actions permitted. As being, if that's just modified, you would just look
where is
at,
it
for
permitted?
Example, 16.
Where is it permitted then for the representatives to bring a lawsuit of this kind against the company?
Well, I would argue this, that if you look at 16.2, for example, governing law and jurisdiction, that if there is a dispute, that you would apply Delaware law and bring an action.
Where in that section does it... refer to the plaintiffs as being the representatives. It doesn't do that.
It does not specifically. That's right, Your Honor.
There is no provision in the agreement that expressly permits the shareholder representatives to bring an action of this
kind. That's not one of the enumerated. That's not specifically enumerated in the agreement, but I don't think that has to be when you look at the breadth of including without limitation. And then it just names two things, or one or two things in 15.5.
It certainly could be inferred. That is your interpretation.
I think
it's a reasonable interpretation.
I think it is. I think from the clear meaning and the clear meaning of that language, that that is the most reasonable interpretation and should be as a matter of law.
But as long as there's any other reasonable interpretation, whether you put the word most in front of it or not, you're into the world of ambiguity, are you not?
No, I'm not. There is no way else to read that provision that any and all actions would include.
If you ignore the rest of what follows, that may be right.
I just disagree with Your Honor that you need to or you must ignore what follows there to take away from the breadth and the all-encompassing nature of that language.
Well, how could you talk about the breadth and the all-encompassing nature of that language without ignoring the limiting language that follows it?
I just disagree with you that it limits the breadth, Your Honor, that language that follows.
All right. In other words, if it isn't prohibited by the agreement, then a lawsuit of this kind is permitted, even though it's not expressly permitted. Is that what you're saying?
By the breadth of that, if there was something expressly prohibiting something in the agreement, it would be a different case. But certainly, the breadth of that statement includes what these gentlemen were jointly chosen and appointed to do. Your Honor,
can you explain to me just how all this plays out in this sense? Let's assume there is a valid third-party beneficiary claim, and for whatever reason, the two shareholder agents cannot agree. So nothing ever happens?
Correct.
Ever?
Ever.
No matter how valid or egregious the wrong that needs to be righted?
Correct. And, Your Honor, that's exactly what's happening now is what, you know, why aren't they acting jointly? As Your Honor asked, why aren't they acting jointly? Well, the fact that we have this language and these protections, the reason why they're not acting jointly is irrelevant. We know they're not acting jointly, and the fact is that that's what these safeguards were designed to prevent. Multiple lawsuits by multiple sets of lawyers in front of different courts.
Well, what if one of the representatives were debilitated?
Well,
we're in a coma.
Okay.
Well, then saying it doesn't matter?
15.5 addresses that. If you go on and read 15.5, and I don't know if it uses the word incapacity, but if they are unable to perform, then there is a provision, if you read down on section 15.5, which would take care of that possibility.
Right. So, what if the representative were corrupted, that is, had been bribed?
Well, they also mentioned fraud as a possible reason that there may need to be a replacement for one of these agents that were appointed. So there is procedurally in the agreement a safeguard in death, incapacity, fraud situations, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As it's a well-established rule of law that for a party to waive a right, especially when it's a particularly valuable right, like the right to bring a cause of action when that party's been aggrieved by another party's misconduct, law is clear that waivers should be clear, express, and unequivocal.
So well established that your brief doesn't contain any supporting authority for it?
Your Honor, we failed to...
Did the court below provide any authority the other way?
I have scoured that opinion, and I still cannot identify what language precisely the court was hanging its determination on. Required or permitted, it's natural understanding. You know, we understand that phrase modifies that, you know, that entire sentence, and that's consistent with my institutional investor client's interests in this case and in connection with. That section in the merger agreement goes on to point out, okay, with respect to indemnification claims, where there's a finite sum of money that's been set aside, you guys go ahead and handle those. But this notion that they've waived their right and given them carte blanche to spend potentially, you know, enormous sums of money pursuing claims, it's just not supported by the language in this agreement.
Did you make any argument or offer proof to the trial court that if we could get into this matter, we would have evidence to establish that when they negotiated this agreement, they specifically considered this and that and the other thing and wrote this language to address one issue but not the other?
No, we never had an opportunity to present oral argument. We specifically requested oral argument. There's a letter, I believe, that it's in the record before this court in which we asked Judge Herlihy to grant us the opportunity.
All right, well, then let me ask you. If you had to make an offer of proof, do you have anything that you believe would support your interpretation of the meaning of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I have the testimony of my clients, who are four of the five signatories to the shareholder representative agreement. There were four, actually, of the board members of Apriva, which negotiated and ratified and approved this agreement. We also have evidence that can be drawn from the facts and circumstances surrounding the various relationships of these parties, and believe that testimony would in fact be conclusive.
Thank you.
Just one final word as my time is up on the assignment. I believe that under 17A, I see I've run out of time. May I finish?
Yes, go ahead.
If there is an infirmity, which we don't believe there is, with respect to the assignment to the litigation committee, which was done simply for efficiency, I believe that under 17A, the appropriate remedy is, in fact, to have the individual members as plaintiffs, and we're happy to do that if that's required. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.